Mackenzie
Lamar.
We're crazy. Musical month is just great. We should do a song every week, you know. Yeah,
Oh, I love it.
Snaps for respect for us. So we're doing a new release this week. We had covered Wicked last year, and we're doing Wicked for Good, the sequel. Well, not sequel, just second half. It's the second half of the musical. Yeah. So I was curious because if those that follow us on social saw that you were going literally every day of the week for 7 or 8 days and seeing a new motion picture in cinemas, I wanted to kind of get a bit of your journey in that, but also just to find out, like, what was your favorite new release that you saw in the last couple weeks?
Oof, yeah, so fun. I decided not to travel for Thanksgiving because for those who know me, I travel a lot for work. So that was my gift for myself to stay home. And so I thought, like, I have time, and I took some time off and I decided to just see a movie every day in theaters because, you know, y'all know your girl loves a challenge because why not? Let's make it a goal. So I did 7 films in 7 days, and really quick, they were Wicked for Good, obviously. Wake Up Dead Man, which is the Knives Out, like another Knives Out entry, if you follow those. Rental Family, which is Brendan Fraser, probably saw those trailers. Eternity. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which I had never actually seen before, which I got a lot of shit for. And The Running Man. And then Blue Moon, which is a Richard Linklater vehicle with Ethan Hawke.
Okay. So, I've only heard of like 4 of those, but I'm curious to know which one was your favorite of the bunch.
It's hard because they're all really different. And also decision-making is hard for me when it comes to picking one thing. However, I think if I just snap back to like the experience of watching it, I feel like Blue Moon was just incredible. It's a really different film. You have to like films with that are writing forward, like the whole thing, like it basically takes place in 2 places and you are in essentially 1 large room for the majority of it. And you are just listening. You are listening and watching them talk. And it is all the writing. And then of course the delivery of the writing. And it's about a really interesting person that a lot of people wouldn't know about. Lorenz Hart, who was actually prior to Rodgers and Hammerstein, speaking of musical month, he was the first writing partner of Richard Rodgers. And he actually died like pretty young. And this is at that transition point where Richard Rodgers is starting to work with Hammerstein. And so it's a really interesting interaction where you see all these historical characters, but it is driven largely by Lorenz Hart's reaction to this whole situation. And you get to just watch Ethan Hawke fucking talk and deliver this incredible script for an hour and a half. And it was just really well done. Really
well
done. You
said Ethan Hawke, and remind, this is the one that's the Richard Linklater?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which Richard Linklater films have I seen? Because I know I've seen like 2, but I haven't seen Boyhood. I haven't seen any of the before. Those are him too, right? Before Sunset.
Yeah, the Befores. The Before Sunset. The Before.
Matthew McConaughey. What? Fucking good. Not Fast Times at Ridgemont High. What's the other one I'm thinking of?
Well, he did a couple of things. He did Everybody Wants Some. Which is
the other one, like, from like the 90s with McConaughey. It's the one everybody knows.
Dazed and Confused is the McConaughey's one.
I apologize. Yeah. We live in Austin. I'm sorry, Matthew, if you're listening right now. I don't know why that was so hard for me to
We've only seen it like 1,200 times. It's just a brain fart. He's done that. And then you didn't see Boyhood with him, I guess. What else would be?
No, and I know that was Oscar nominated. I brought it all up to say, I feel like with those couple exceptions of sort of the throwback, I hesitate to call them period pieces, but that's kind of, to me, that's what they are. But like, he seems to be all in on doing sort of like, I'm not going to call them gimmicky, but sort of like different, unique sort of stories. So Boyhood was that, and the trilogy you mentioned before. It sounds like this is kind of that too, where it's unique in the fact that it's only a couple settings. Most of it takes place in one room. Like, I feel like
it struck me as like a play.
Okay.
You know, it really, I mean, you being like a former theater teacher, me being a theater kid, like if you watched it, I think you would get play. you would be like, this is a stage play. Because he's walking around this one, basically this one bar throughout, and it's like a large restaurant and bar. And it's, you don't need a lot to change the setting. And it's really just the witty repartee. And he's a writer talking about how important it is to write well. And it comes through in the incredible writing of this script. So it's just, it's like meta in all these ways that I thought were really, really cool.
Okay. I'll check that one out when it becomes streaming. But the last thing I have to ask before we get to the show today is, I'm scared to ask. We have covered Shaun of the Dead and Baby Driver in the last like 4 months on the pod. How was the new Running Man by Edgar Wright? Because I've heard mixed things.
I think it's great. Okay. I think it's really, really well done. And I think it kind of has a stamp of approval from some of the OG, including Schwarzenegger, who was like asked specifically about, you know, would you want any of these films remade? And he was like, on the whole, no. Like, I think these 80s action films are perfect as they are. But he said, he used to say back then, and I don't know how true this is, that he always felt Running Man was one of the ones that could benefit from a little bit better budget. Not because it wasn't well done, but like if they had more budget, they could do an even better job.
Right.
And so that's what he feels like this version was, you know, a one with a better budget. And I think everybody's performances are incredible. And y'all know I'm a Glenn Powell fan, but I do like that this one's a little bit different for him. I think it's a little bit edgier. He's a little bit, you know, just harsher and more intense in this one. And so I think it held up. If you like the original, I don't think it's like offensive. Our buddies at Prime Cut did an ep on it. So if y'all, okay. If y'all are interested, go listen to that for some comparison.
Well, I mean, I'm glad to hear that Arnold has given his thumbs up on the higher budget version of The Running Man. Are you excited for next year's higher budget version of Street Fighter, which we covered on the pod?
I'm not going to ever watch that. I'm never going to watch Street Fighter anything ever again. I've retired. Like from Dawn of the Dead as well. That was, speaking of Fanjan coming up, somebody else was like, let's do Dawn of the Dead again. And I was like, absolutely
not. Run it back?
Not.
You want to run it back?
We're not doing it. We're not doing it, guys.
Okay.
But yeah, go check out if you want to learn about a little bit more about the rest of them on our Instagram. I've got a little highlight about the 7 days of movies. So feel free to check it out. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are continuing musical month, my new favorite month, for December here. We're only on our second entry and we actually rejiggered things a little bit because this is a new release and we thought it would be pretty relevant to talk about it like right now if you guys want to. So we are doing Wicked for Good.
Is that the best sequel title they could have come up with here?
I think so. Of the low-hanging fruit of the songs and the, like, instead of just saying two. I mean, if you wanted it to just not be, like, Wicked 2. Because it's not really two. You know what I mean? Like you said in the opening. It's, like, it's just the second half.
What about, like, more Wicked? More Wicked? Would that have tried, like...
Extra Wicked?
Wickeder?
Wickeder? That feels like we're, like, I don't know. This feels like a Boston thing. Like...
Wicked smart? Wicked...
Wicked something, wicked extra, like, but the other songs, like, it's like No Good Deed in this. And I mean, it could, you know what it could have been, but it would be really long. Wicked, No Place Like Home, because that is one of the other songs.
So it feels though, without getting into, well, never mind. I will save that for when we get into spoiler show. It's a new release, so I will wait.
Okay. Okay, we'll wait. All right. But to get us through this, we thought it would be fun to like do a little throwback, actually. I am wearing like the same earrings, the same outfit. I nixed the hat this time, you guys. I'm sorry. I didn't want to dig it out of the attic. But we are doing the same cocktails, but we did it. We did it a little bit different this time. So what are we drinking?
So yeah, we swapped last time. I did the Glinda-inspired drink and you did the Elphaba-inspired drink this time. I am doing Elpha Buzzed, which is 2 ounces of bourbon, half an ounce of ginger liqueur, half an ounce of limoncello, 0.25 ounces of blue curacao, and 0.75 ounces of honey syrup with a squeeze of lemon juice in there. Shake it, strain it into a glass. This is Elpha Buzzed. And what are you doing?
I'm doing the popular Cosmo, and I think the best part of that is that I'm still doing, like, the Elphaba, you know, dressed. I'm dressed like Elphaba, but I get to do a little little pinky something. So this is a play on a Cosmo. It's obviously got vodka, 2 ounces of vodka, half ounce of lime, and 0.75 is the note if you like it a little tart, which I do. So I tried that a little bit. 0.5 ounces of Cointreau, 2.25 ounces of Simple, and then a half ounce or a little less if you want of cranberry juice. It's really just for the color. And then you can do an optional sugar rim. That's not my energy, so I opted out. I did, however, do some cocktail glitter that I don't think is coming through on camera, but I did glitter it up a little bit. Oh, you can kind of see it.
We'll have to believe you. Yeah, we'll take
your word for it. There it is. All right. So anyway, this is a popular Cosmo. So cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. I hadn't gotten to try this last time, so I thought like it would be fun to switchy. This is fun.
And I did forget, because we're doing a run back. These are from always at Craft World, so shout out. Mm-hmm. We are reusing the recipe, but still crafted by at Craft World.
I feel like your green is better than my green. If I recall how my green came out, I feel like your green came out so nice.
It's the right color. It did. Yeah. Yeah. I'm a fan.
All right. Go team. Okay, so we're going to do some really quick basics and then a spoiler warning because, again, this is brand spanking new. We're also going to keep it kind of quick because this just came out in theaters, and to be perfectly honest, we had to watch it in theaters. We didn't take a lot of notes.
Frown upon you having a flashlight and a notepad while you're watching motion pictures or recording it. Like, I got yelled at for both. So, guys, my notes are not going to be great.
Leave it to Lamar to get in trouble at the movies. I would never. I'm a good kid. Okay.
Oh, I thought this was America.
You're that one that, like, the Alamo voicemail, you know? Like, excuse United me States for...
Magnited States of America.
Oh, yeah. So good. Okay.
If you have no idea what we're talking about, go to YouTube. It's on there. Just look up Alamo Drafthouse PSA and listen to the voicemail. They were left by somebody who got kicked out for talking. Those of you who are respectful when you go to the cinema, even if you don't have a draft house near you, will really appreciate that voicemail.
So good. We might even just share it to her stories to make it easy for you. It's pretty fucking hysterical. Okay, so obviously we're talking about Wicked for Good 2025. This is rated 7 out of 10 on IMDb right now. And currently a 68% from critics, which, like, ooh, interesting. And 93% from audiences. So again, this is still like in progress. Might change. I don't know. But I was kind of surprised by the critic response.
My big takeaway from this is that it's not that it's an unfair critique of the movie, but a lot of the weaknesses of the film are rooted in the musical. So I've seen the musical live. It's fair to say, I think, that the back half, like after the act break, after Defying Gravity, is not as strong as the first. Not to say that it's horrible, but something about it feels a little off. The pacing, the music is not as catchy. It's still, I like the crossover, but most of this feels like, hey, remember this from The Wizard of Oz? This is how it ties into this story that we spent the first half building up, which is more original and to the point, and therefore a little more engaging, I think. But it's not really fair to be like, well, this movie sucks, because it's they're not going to change everything from the musical. I think they could have improved a few things, but we'll get into that.
One, I think it's one half of a whole. So, like, y'all got to keep that in mind. I don't know that they should have split it up for this reason, would be my one comment. Two, welcome to musical theater, kids. This is how musical theater works. The first act is always the strongest. Like, this, it literally is. It's always the strongest. Your anchor song is usually closing the first act. It's a set formula. The, like, heavy, harder parts of musical theater are typically in the second half. So it's not even a Wicked thing. It's a musical theater thing. So it's to keep you coming back after intermission, right? And it's so, so strong in that first half that I think it's really hard to do a direct comparison. I've also seen it live, seen on Broadway a few times, actually. And the second half is always harder. I think it's just darker. And I think that's the point also of this story. You're supposed to see how the Wicked Witch of the West has evolved into the person and becoming this kind of persona that she is. And then the last comment I'll make is that it is also about the source material, the book Wicked by Gregory Maguire is where all of this is built from. And this is how that story goes by and large. So it does kind of take this darker turn in that second half, but I get why
audiences called it Wicked Shit Gets Real.
Real. Yes.
By the end of this episode, we will have a better title than Wicked for Good. That's a top contender right now.
Yeah, it is. It is. I like it. It is that. It is the shit gets real half. could call out.
I feel like if you did a double feature, it would be as if you were watching the musical, it would be easier to stomach because you head straight from Defying Gravity, you get a 15-minute break, you know, intermission, and then you watch the rest of it. I feel like a year between was it's a little harder to sit down and be reinvesting in these characters without that buildup. So I get where you're coming from of it. Should be like they just released Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair. Should be Wicked, The Whole Bloody Affair. Release that in theaters. And I think it'll go over a little more positively.
I agree. I think the theater format like works for a reason, you know, and I have no problem with us extending it and making it into this bigger production. But I agree. Like, I think it could have happened all at once and done really well. I mean, even like totally different genre, of course, but The Brutalist did do that. It gave us that intermission and we were kind of like able to come back and watch the rest of this. And so I don't know. I feel like we could have maybe done that here and maybe that's what critics are responding to. Anyways, okay, we're gonna go through some more basics and then we'll give you a little bit more of a spoiler warning. We have covered all of these basics before, so I'm gonna go fast.
Go listen to the first episode.
Go listen to the first one. Writer director John M. Chu did Crazy Rich Asians and some other stuff that we won't get into. Source material, like I said, really complicated, actually. There's a lot of people involved in this. Wicked by Stephen Schwartz, who did the music for the Broadway musical. Winnie Holtzman, who did the book. Wicked by Gregory Maguire as well, which is the original novel. And then from a film perspective, we have contributions all around, again, from Chu, the director, but also Dana Fox to the screenplay. And then we got to shout out the original character inspiration for all of those things is from L. Frank Baum, who did The Wizard of Oz. And if y'all remember my prior show and tell, I had the book on the shelf, but he's the guy who gave us all these characters at the end of the day. And then music is by, again, this got a little bit complicated when we came to the film because more people got involved and there's like a second score in this whole thing that we talked about a little bit last time. But ultimately, the underscore here is John Powell and the score and songs is Stephen Schwartz as well. And then from a film perspective, we also introduce the Stephen Oremus who conducted the original score comes in as well. So we have the original score from the Broadway film or Broadway musical. And then we have an incidental underscore in the film versions. And then we have the songs and the lyrics as well. So lots of people involved in the music.
And they added, didn't they add songs to this to kind of pad it out a little bit and to give?
They did. And I would, they did add a little bit of songs.
But
and
that
they
was
add,
all
again,
still
they,
by the original writers?
It was by some of the original writers. Yes. Okay, Stephen Schwartz did still do it. And then again, the score that got added is all still John Powell, but it's a whole secondary underscore in a way that you don't need in a musical, right? Because like, as you know, in films, obviously there's a lot, usually a running score throughout. So the incidental underscore in the film is still John Powell.
Got it.
So it's a lot. We did do a deep dive on that in the first one as well, if you feel like checking it out. But it is a lot of cooks in this kitchen is what I would say. All right. Cast and crew is largely the same. Not going to cover all the exact same people as last time, but the core ones we will. Cynthia Erivo obviously is our Elphaba. Incredible singing voice. She also sings in Harriet, which is one of the ones I called out last time that I wanted to shout out. We obviously also have Ariana Grande, who has an incredible voice, does Glinda, you know. Hmm. She's done a bunch of TV, as we know, obviously incredible album
Don't
work
Look Up,
across.
Which you haven't seen still.
I still haven't seen it.
She
I know.
She plays a singer. I don't know that it's, I don't remember if she's, I don't think she's playing herself, but she plays a singer, like a pop star in that. And she's quite funny.
I think she's really like, she's so, so talented. Her music is not like my go-to, but I just think you can't argue that she has an incredible voice. And I remember one of the times that stood out to me, and I might've said this last time, so I apologize if you've heard it before, is that she appeared on a late night show. I can't remember which, and they had her do impressions. I think it was Jimmy Fallon. They had her do impressions of other artists, other famous artists' singing voices. And she did like a Mariah Carey impression, a Streisand impression, or whatever. She did a bunch of great artists and she fucking crushed it. So she just is an incredibly powerful, talented girl with an incredible voice. So I love that she got to play this role, you know, at the end of the day. Yeah. Another person who I love in his role is Mr. Jeff Goldblum, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. Yes, he is an asshole, but fuck, he's so good at it. I love it so much. another thing I love him in that got canceled. I don't think it had gotten canceled when we talked about this last, but it has since been canceled and makes me so sad, is Chaos on Netflix. He did recently, and it's like a Greek mythology modernization story. And I thought it was so creative and well done, and it did not get renewed. I was very sad.
That's a bummer. I wrote down randomly, I was trying to think of Jeff Goldblum things we might not have mentioned. And I was like, he's in the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But then I went down a rabbit hole and I was like, how many different alien inspired films has he done? He did that. He did Independence Day. He did Earth Girls Are Easy. I'm sure there's more. So I'd be curious, like, of actors in Hollywood outside of like franchises like Alien with Sigourney Weaver, like, who's been in the most alien motion pictures? Jeff Goldblum's probably up there, I would think.
He's a contender, I would guess, but he's also maybe an alien. He's just like, so
even in this, he's kind of an illegal alien. Like, he's not from Oz. Like,
he's not. He's definitely lying for sure. I like him. He's a good alien. If he's an alien, I'm glad we got him. He's great. I like him a lot. Michelle Yeoh plays Madame Warrable. She does a really good job of getting worse and worse in the second half. She does everything
about Michelle Yeoh or Madame Warrable or both?
Madame Warrable. I would never say that about Michelle Yeoh.
Wait till we get into spoiler territory. I'm not happy today.
Oh, okay. I am excited. All right. But she's in Everything Everywhere All at Once, if you didn't know, and a few other things. And then Jonathan Bailey, Mr. People's Sexiest Man Alive, first gay man to represent. Congrats, Jonathan Bailey.
For you.
Plays Fiero, and he did Bridgerton and all these other things. He can pull off a straight guy is why, I think, is a big part of it. And in Bridgerton, he does a real great job. He is incredibly hot. So well-deserved, my guy. Ethan Slater plays Block, and he's done a bunch of things. I mentioned last time, one of my favorites is Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, is just in general something I think everybody should watch, and he's in that. And then Marissa Bodhi plays Nessa Rose, and she really comes into her own in this half as well. And she's done just mostly stage stuff and some shorts, but she did do a film called You're Adorable, which I still haven't seen. And then we don't see Peter Dinklage much in this half. He really just does a quick,
Does he get credit on this?
I think he gets credited, but I don't think he does not have a single like speaking line in the final product. Okay. So I didn't want to shout him out necessarily, but I just think he is such a critical part of this show and he was in the first story. One. Like, he did, and he's in the record, first one. Like,
yeah.
Totally. But the other one I did want to mention that does get a speaking part in this one is Colman Domingo gets to be the voice of the Cowardly Lion. And we love him. He's been in a few things. I think he's great.
He was in Sing Sing, which you recommended, and I loved, really loved him in that. And did you know he was an executive producer? Remember how we were talking about favorite movies from this past year that we did, and we talked about It's What's Inside and how we both, that blew us away?
Oh, yeah.
He was an EP
I thought that was pretty cool. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Man, he's so fucking talented. He also just was in The Running Man, fun fact of the 7 days, seven films thing.
Full circle.
He was in The Running Man, and he plays the TV show host of The Running Man, and he does a really incredible job at that. So, yeah, he's great. We love him. Okay, quick plot summary for the second half, and then we will go into spoiler territory. So, Elphaba, the future Wicked Witch of the West, and her relationship with Glinda, the Good Witch of the North, the second of a two-part feature film adaptation of the Broadway musical. Okay, so much information.
That doesn't really tell me the plot. That just says, hey, did you see the
fucking
musical?
Nothing. Y'all, part of the entertainment of this for me is to read them in real time with you and have a reaction. That was a really bad one. Okay, kids, turn around. Don't drown. It's spoiler time. All right, take me right into the Michelle Yeoh of it all. What are you talking about? What are you mad about?
I said, go back. I stand by my belief. I said at the first Wicked that we did recording, I said, I think Michelle Yeoh is kind of miscast in this. This is based on seeing the musical.
I don't remember that, but okay, okay, okay.
And then seeing it, then we touched on it. It was probably
very
brief.
Is it because you're racist or what?
No, because I wanted to point this out. I was like, before I start critiquing, I wanted to point out Michelle Yeoh, to her credit, is one of only two. It's so weird for me to say it. Like, I hated how this was phrased on IMDb. Is one of two actresses of color. And I personally, that rubs me the wrong way just reading that out loud. So I'm going to say non-white actresses who has won Best Actress at the Oscars. Like, one of two.
Yeah.
Do you know who the other one is, just for fun?
Halle Berry.
Yes, Monsters Ball. Well done. Yeah. So I'm here to say I love Michelle Yeoh. Everything Everywhere All at Once might have been my favorite of that year. But in this, there is something, it still just eats at me, of Madame Morrible is the wizard has, Jeff Goldblum has this charisma about him, and he's a very different type of villain than what she is supposed to represent. Mm-hmm. But the way that she delivers her line, and it has nothing to do, like, I know we make the joke about races, it has nothing to do with her accent or her race, it's her intonation and her delivery, to me, is just so flat. By the end of this, really, we should end up hating her almost as much as we do the wizard, but I think because her delivery is so stoic, mm-hmm. and like, the witch is doing this, we must blah, 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 blah. Everything is so one note and flat for me that she delivers, and even her singing in this does not hit for me. I love Michelle Yeoh. I do not love her in this role.
I think that's fair criticism. I think that's totally fair. I mean, because just thinking about it, like, I don't know. Maybe I think what I'm reconciling with right now as you're saying that is I think I have a lot of takeaways from the musical that sort of, I don't know, brush over some things like that, where it's like, I know that we're supposed to hate her. I know how it evolves. I know the story that this is coming from. So it's almost not, maybe it's just not as noticeable to me, but as you say it, I'm like, yeah, she does have like kind of a monotone delivery here and there. She has like one intense scene with Glinda, which I did like, but if you think about it, it's not like she just says harsh things. It's not so much the delivery of it. But I also recognize that it maybe it was an intentional choice to kind of have this like almost a sociopathic, like monotone delivery of like pure unadulterated ambition and, you know, just having no emotions or empathy or intonation for that reason. Maybe it was a choice, but I agree. I could see that. But I do, again, I think like I know that you're supposed to hate her. So I do definitely think that I hated her by the end of this film, you know?
She also doesn't even get, I know that, guys, just to be clear, we said this at the beginning, we're going to jump all over the place today because we weren't allowed to take straight notes, so we can go wherever we want with this, but I don't like that her character at the end doesn't even really get a comeuppance. Like, you want something really bad, and it's just like, you're going to jail. Bye. And meanwhile, it's Glinda, who, to her knowledge, has had no magic this whole time, and Morrible has, and again, this isn't the fault of the movie, it's the musical, but it's like Morrible has been doing all this crazy sorcery, crafting tornadoes and shit, but it's just like, oh, I guess I'm under arrest, bye. Like, I wanted there to be more of a final battle. You wanted her or to something.
Be burned at the stake, or
could an Elphaba have taken maybe her out,
you know?
yeah.
You're like, I want blood, I want blood and fire and flames.
It just feels like, for how much, you know, we've spent 5.5 hours or 6 hours with these characters and God, the two main time, villains at the end, the wizard gets banished and he just goes back home,
goes in a balloon,
bad, and Madame Morrible just goes to prison, but I don't know, it's not very satisfying as far as like the antagonists getting their comeuppance.
Yeah, I think maybe it's so funny. It's funny that you say that out loud now. The more I think of it, I'm like, well, you know, this is like probably realistic punishment. But to be fair, like, we are not living in a reality. Like, this is one, a musical and make-believe and all these things. Like, why isn't it bigger and more intense? There's magic involved. There's all these things. Like, if we are playing make-believe in this story as we are, why is it so real in the form of jail? You know, well, that's a good call. So
here's the thing. I know that people don't want there to be huge changes when you're going from book to movie or musical to movie. Like, you want it to be honest to the subject matter or true to the subject matter. Mm-hmm. But in this case, they do change things in this to try and make the second half of Wicked a little better or more palatable compared to the first half. Why can't we? This is a movie. We can do on stage. I get why you can't do some grand magic battle between Glinda and more. Why can't we make that happen when it's a motion picture? Couldn't we have thrown something else in there now that we have more budget and like camera work to do?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think it's fair feedback, because like let's spend a second on that. Actually, let's talk about what they changed. Because again, we've warned you, spoilers. There's this whole, like, there's that where, like, they, you know, kind of change this dynamic at the end. They also show a little bit more of Dorothy and Co. in this one, which they don't in the Broadway film. Like, they allude to them, certainly, but it's,
you
like,
see, if I remember correctly, it's a lot of, like, silhouettes. Like, you see the characters,
it's
in
silhouettes
the
behind
the
a screen
stage.
And you're waving at them, like, she, you know, Galinda sends them on their way, you know, does that whole thing, and then you get this great conversation. I actually have loved that in the musical, and the way that it was handled, of this, like, they're so close to this parallel storyline, and you cut to Elphaba and Galinda talking about it. I really liked how that was handled in the musical, and yeah, they kind of do a little bit more of that in this that I don't think is totally necessary. Again, I think it adds time. I think it's part of how you end up with, right, it pads it out into these two films. The other one is the showing the yellow brick road being built in more detail, and like all the animals having to do that under forced labor. They really lean in the movie into the animal forced labor captivity storyline, which I think is compelling from a motivational standpoint. You know, you're getting more of why Elphaba is so angry and why she should be. But what I will say about that I think is a little bit detrimental to the film is that despite all of that, she does reconsider joining the wizard, which works better in the stage play, I think, or in the musical play, for this reason, because you don't get as much of that deep dive. You don't get as much visual affirmation of how bad this forced labor and animal situation is. And when she goes and talks to the wizard, he sort of charms her again. And I think in the musical that works a little better because you haven't seen it in the same way you have in the film. So I would say that's one of the changes that maybe doesn't help and maybe is why people are responding the way they are.
The only positive I think that comes out of that because for the most part, I'm in agreement with you. It does feel a little heavy handed to get across the point of like, this is a villain, and it makes her being willing to side with him a little less believable. You're like, wait, really? You're just going to change your mind?
Yeah. You're going to just like switch gears again, maybe. Yeah.
But it does give us that awesome shot where as Glinda is walking the aisle upstairs, we get Elphaba coming downstairs and seeing the animal cages. I thought that was really well done. How it was cutting back and forth between the two of them taking these big steps. And that obviously is what takes us into sort of the last half of the film. I'd also say, dude, like, not to go too tarp too much on this, but two of the things that we mentioned before that were added into this, they added more for Glinda, because in the back half, it is very Elphaba focused in the musical. Yeah. So they added a song. They added the flashback of her as a child and showing how hurt she was that she couldn't do magic. You've spent this whole movie adding those things to make you empathize more with Glinda of the fact that she can't do magic. We have Elphaba give her the wand and the book of like, now you can do magic. Why the fuck doesn't that logically end with her doing magic on Morrible? Like Morrible being like, you can't do magic, I'm going to kill you. And then her reversing the spell, she can still go to jail. But like, why not have a final show and make more of this? And it kind of solves those two issues that I was talking about, like Morrible and Glinda.
I think you have to do one or the other a little bit. Like, you have to like not let her have magic, or you do have to commit to the bit to the way you're saying. I think the committing to the bit version, though, takes you too far away from the source material, at least for me. It would take you, for me, I think maybe that's what I would struggle with. I hear what you're saying of like the gaps now because of that. But I think if we actually saw her do it, I would be like, whoa. I think I would have a reaction to that of like, we don't ever see that. That doesn't happen for her. And the reason I think that would be hard to watch is like at the end of the day, I said this in like my little 7 days and seven films review where I didn't want to give spoilers, but I was like, it's like a Gotham kind of situation, right? Of like the hero that Gotham deserves, but not the one we need right now. Mm-hmm. Like Elphaba at the end of the day is the hero that they deserve, but not the one that they need. And this is why they pivot to Glinda the way that they do. But at the end of the day, she is the hero. She's the one you're supposed to believe who has done all the right things for the right reasons, even though it didn't work out. It doesn't work out with her, you know, leading Oz and being, you know, all these things. I think if you were to give Glinda the actual magic and us see it at the end, it flips that. It turns Glinda into the hero. It turns Glinda into having come, gotten rid of Madame Morrible, gotten rid of the wizard, and have like come into her own, which is not a bad thing. It's not something I don't want for her, but I think it changes the story kind of almost fundamentally, where she becomes this hero.
Isn't that the point,
hero.
Though? Like, isn't that why Elphaba is willing to be exiled and to say, no, you have to paint me as the villain so they can see you as the hero? Like, I think that having
I do, Glinda but I think she hasn't fully earned it yet, is what I'm saying. I think the implication is supposed to be that she's gonna, you know, she's gonna learn the magic that she can, and she's gonna do the best she can to lead Oz. And I think that that's all good, right? I just think she hasn't earned it yet. And Elphaba has earned it and tried her best. And even if it didn't work, you know, she's still the hero of this particular story. And I think Glinda's gonna be later, you know?
Yeah, fair.
Okay, I have one more thing that I want to talk about that they added that I don't totally love, even though I think most people did. I think it's one of the additions that everyone else liked and maybe I didn't like. They add a sex scene for Fiyero and Elphaba.
But it what is
were your,
like,
what were your thoughts of that?
I wrote down, it's the most asexual sex. It's the most
I couldn't
PG,
even take a sip. I almost spit it out.
The most PG rating conscious sex scene of all. Not since Madonna's Like a Prayer has there been a more innocent sounding and looking like sex scene conveyed on camera.
But the way it's shot is so weird and so bad. Like, she
they're
goes
not even in the same room.
No, they're not even in the same room during the foreplay, right? Like, they're walking around this treehouse, which also this treehouse is bomb. Like, I love this. It's so cool. But she's got this, like, she's supposed to be getting comfortable and sexy, right? And she's, like, getting into this different outfit, which is totally fine. But then she puts this horrible sweater over it. And so,
like,
just
in John Wick, where Lord Fishburne is like the king of the sewers or whatever the fuck his character is. Like, that's the shawl she's putting
the
on.
The shawl. God, yeah. It's so bad. And it's like, she just like, I'm just going to give you a little shoulder action and it's going to make it sexy. And it's like, nah, girl, nah, it is not working. So it's like, it just the lead up again. Like, and I don't think this is a Jonathan Bailey is gay thing because he's super hot and he has pulled this off. I think it is the direction of this scene does not give me sex vibes. And then they have this relatively PG kiss and all that. And listen, that's fine. It's not in the movie. In the musical, they have this great kiss and you know
it's the levitating like, thing is cool. I'm like, okay, that's cute.
That's
I
cool.
Like that,
but like
I like that
we
such
don't
a little
need all
thing.
The rest of it.
It's such a little thing, but I like how when she levitates him, she still keeps him like 6 inches taller than her because the guy's got to be taller. She's
got to be taller.
She's got to look up at him with those eyes. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. I don't know. I just, I think it doesn't, I don't think it's quite necessary. It doesn't give sexy the way that they, I think we're going for. Is
not
what I would
since
say.
Nala in The Lion King gave Simba the F me eyes. During Can You Feel the Love Tonight? Have I been like, okay, I see what's happening here, but we're not able to put that on screen because this is in the children. Yeah.
She really does. Like, the animation of that is legit. Yeah. Anyway. Oh, okay. I just had to get all
that. That was
out.
A lot.
Sorry.
I know.
There was a lot. I just had to think. There's actually I'm more that they added, up, but those were the big ones for me.
Ooh, I need a cigarette. Okay. But spinning off of that, since we're focused on that, I wanted to touch on the music and why I think to what we've been talking about. There are good songs in this one. I don't think there's anything on par with either Popular or Defying Gravity. I think those, if you were to ask most people their favorite songs from Wicked, those are probably number one and two. I would say that No Good Deed is pretty damn good.
That's
I
the
think
next
that
one.
One is
yeah.
probably the best set piece in this. What about you?
That's the anchor of the second half, for yeah. sure. For sure. No Good Deed is supposed to be Elphaba's Defying Gravity Part 2, right? Mm-hmm. But I think the difference is that I wonder if it, I mean, I'm like getting really analytical here as I'm saying this out loud, but Defying Gravity is a little bit of her, like, she's making this transitional choice of, I have to go do this thing for the betterment of everybody, right? Like, I'm going to go save the world. And it's so empowering, right? Think about that in like, just even in your youth, right? Of when you were like idealistic and motivated and you want to go, you know, whatever your thing was at that time, you're going to college, you're volunteering, you're doing whatever it is. Like, you're really passionate about this thing and you're hopeful that you're going to make that impact. That's Defying Gravity. She's like, yeah. I'm going to go do this. I'm going to fucking crush. I'm going to save the world, right? No Good Deed is her accepting that she's never going to do it the way she wanted to, right? It's not turning out the way that she thought. They are not accepting her the way that she intended. She's still a good person, but they refuse to see it, right? They refuse to see the good things about her. And it's going to take, you know, it's like moving the Titanic to get them to understand. So fuck it. I am the Wicked Witch of the West. And this is her like accepting her new identity and leaning into it. And even John Chu was like given a giving an interview about it. He was like, this is her fuck it song. This is her saying like, fuck it. This is who I am now. If this is who you think I am, fine. That's what I'm going to fucking do. And I think it's her F you song, which in this, in a hero story cannot be as strong as the like idealistic, I'm going to go do the thing song, you know? So I don't know. I think it's a little bit of that. And she's a little bit more bitter. She's a little bit hardened. She's a little bit darker at this point. And I think that's what's happening in the second half a little bit.
I agree. My theory, and I'll get into why that I think this is a weakness of the musical in some ways, but my theory is that that song, the pacing of the second half of this, because the first half of Wicked is building up these characters. As I said, you're seeing this original story come mm-hmm. to light and you're telling this new tale. The second yeah. half of this is so handcuffed to the action taking place in Wizard of Oz that the pacing has to go yeah. at a breakneck pace. The first hour of this film mm-hmm. was a fucking slog. Like, it was so slow mm-hmm. until they get to Oz and we have Wonderful, which I think is one of the other good songs in this when mm-hmm. Jeff Goldblum gets his chance to shine. But because this is so married to Wizard of Oz, my theory is that No Good Deed really represents, okay, this is Elphaba explaining why all of the shit that she does in Wizard of Oz, all the evil stuff aligns. Like, she's like, you want me to be a yeah. villain? I'll be a villain. But we gloss yeah. over it. And within like 15 minutes of that song is when she's like, actually, I shouldn't be bad anymore. It has to happen to make the ending of this make sense, but it is so breakneck pace of like the way things happen in this. But that's my theory, is they're saying, hey, all that bad stuff we're not showing you of her setting, like throwing fire at the characters in Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
We're explaining that away with a song.
Yeah, I think that's fair feedback. I think the other thing I would say is that we have a fundamental shift in pacing when you take it from the musical to two films, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that is one of the things that does a disservice to the story in general. Of it's not because this, like, I think if anybody watches a musical, they some of these things that we're calling out, they would never call out, right? They would never say like, you know, the second half songs aren't as good. You would never put it in that context because of the format right. and the pacing and all the things of the musical. I think we only notice those things because the pacing has dramatically changed and you expect more from the story as a result. And mm-hmm. I agree that they don't line all those points up in the same way and as cleanly in this one. Another one that I like, though, that I do think does a lot to set us up in the second half is the thank goodness I couldn't be happier scene. That is really compelling the way that they do that and the cutaway between Galinda and Fiero and the audience, you know, the Munchkin and Munchkin Land and all of that. And you see they actually perform this so well of the, I couldn't be happier. And you can see how not happier they are, mm-hmm. right? Like how it's fake and it's this persona. And I think it's the first glimpse we get at the beginning of the second act to how much of this is performative. And you can tell this is this shift for Fiero as well, who I think as a character is the one who has some of the most growth in this whole story of him realizing how much of this is, he has to put one version forward for Glinda and Munchkin Land and Oz and all these things versus what he's actually battling with internally and what he actually thinks is important, which, you know, eventually comes out in the later songs.
I think Fiero anchors a good chunk of the story here. For as much as Elphaba and Glinda are the focuses, I do think that Fiero is kind of a yeah. through line that makes this all more interesting. And obviously he even yeah. gets tied into the Wizard of Oz of it all. And circles yeah. back at the end. But like, I don't know, dude, there's some components of this, and it's, again, the musical is mostly to blame here, but like Nessa Rose, I feel, is completely underdeveloped for when she does her big heel turn. Like they just, mm-hmm. I remember her in the first one in a couple of scenes of she's at the dance and like she has a crush on Bach and blah, blah, blah. But then in this one, it's like we cut however many years ahead and suddenly she's kind of a dick and it's not really explained.
She's holding him hostage.
Yeah. I went through the Reddit threads and was kind of trying to remember things from the movie, and people said, oh, in the book, it's much more better explained of why Nessa Rose is this darling daughter, overprivileged. Her parents like baby coddled her basically. And that's why she ends up being jealous of Elphaba and all of this. And I'm like, that's cool. But they don't explain it in the movie. And in this, it's just, She's mean to her sister. Her sister comes back. She's happy about her sister. Then her sister does something bad. She's mad at her sister again. She's like holding this guy hostage. The whole tornado thing, as awesome as it looks visually, it's just silly to me that she's out there in her chair, like screaming his name, and then gets a howl. Yeah. Like, I think it's supposed to be a heartbreaking moment, but it almost feels comedic because of how much you dislike the character at that point. I don't know.
Well, I agree totally that you don't get the development to give you the hard left turn into her being evil, right? Because she becomes the Wicked Witch of the East, for context, for those who want to put this in frame of Wizard of Oz, right? Of like, she is the Wicked Witch of the East by the end of this whole narrative. And she really, we see her really become that. But the places I think they focus on to make her that are problematic. Right. So they add in this whole secondary plot line about Munchkinland and keeping Munchkins in Munchkinland and not letting them travel. In addition to the animal control and limiting animal travel and their ability to speak, there's this other new form of discrimination that they add in this film about how, like, why Bok is there and he has to stay there and all these things. And that is, it does something to add that she is getting worse, but it roots her only in Bok is what broke her. And I don't think that's fair. Like, I don't, that's not fair.
No,
from
it should
the
be
story
her dynamic with her sister. And that's never
with
explained.
Her sister, with her family, with all the things you just mentioned. Exactly. And they don't give you enough of that. Cause it's like, it feeds too much into that trope of like, hell hath no fury, like a woman scorned vibe. And that's not all that this is. This is deeper rooted than that. And I think that's detrimental to like portraying women on screen, right? If she just lost her mind because this man wouldn't love her. And that's not fair, you know? She devolves in over a longer period of time in more ways. So I agree. I think that's a fair criticism of the way that she evolves. Absolutely.
Yeah, Nessa is a weakness in this. I think the tie-ins to Wizard of Oz are, I do like the way they're done. I like that we see shots of Dorothy and then we obviously hear dialogue from all of the other characters from that. I really like, it's such a throwaway.
And in the
line.
Musical, the tie-ins are really strong. Like, I think they had to have them and they're really well done.
Yeah. I like when Glinda, you know, we get that famous scene of like Dorothy skipping off in the slippers or whatever. And she says, bye Dorothy, bye Dodo. I just like, Ariana Grande, the comedy in this, it's obviously not as light as the first film, but Ariana Grande, I don't think they could give her enough to do in this because she does crush even the fight sequence, which should be cheesy and hokey.
I was literally about to say, we got to talk about the like, come on, Greenie. It's so fucking funny.
It's when she does the Wicked Witch laugh and she's like, where'd you get that from? Like, where was that stolen from? And it's just,
I love that. I think, we got to spend a minute for Ariana Grande's second half here, because even though I think that they underdevelop her like magical goals and how she becomes a little bit more heroic here, she is really funny in the second half and she brings some of the only humor. Right. Like, and we need some to reprieve us a little bit. And part of it is a little bit sad, right? Because like I said, in the Thank Goodness I Couldn't Be Happier, you can tell that she knows something is wrong and this doesn't feel right. And all
she
these things.
She keeps doing the like, right, dear? Yes, dear? Like,
right,
like
dear? Yes, dear?
Agree. Yeah.
But it's like that forced cheeriness that she has of like, I'm going to make everything work. And you get this background story of her trying to do that, that I agree with you. I don't think contributes as well as they would like, but I get the concept. I get the concept of like, here's why she is the way that she is. But man, she ends up being funny throughout. She lightens every scene that she's in. I love the fight. Come on, Greenie. And like, she loves her. They love each other, but this is like sisters fighting it out of like, I will fuck you up, you know? And it plays that way in a really funny way of like, they don't actually want to hurt each other. They're just mad. They're just mad at each other. And she gives us a lot of that. Like the way she plays that gives us a lot of that. And I really like her, the lightness that she brings to this, and especially in the bubble. When she gets her bubble and she's just geeking out over this bubble. And I love how annoyed Madame Morrible is, but she's like, are you not seeing the bubble? Like, are you not? Look at this. This is so, oh, like she's just playing with it. I would 100% do this. Like, I am not a Glinda, and I would play with that bubble for hours. That's a fun, silly toy. And if you got one of those, you would have a great time with it. And I just love, like, how relatable she is in that moment and how silly and how funny, even though one of her mentors is looking at her and judging her. And she's like, fuck it. I just, like, love this bubble.
That's it's. They don't lean into the second half of the musical is about Elphaba for the most part. Like 80% of it is Elphaba and her interactions with Dorothy, and Glinda kind of takes a back seat. And I get why they want to beat, but I just feel like they could have leaned into Ariana Grande's talents and comedic chops a little more in this to make this a little more enjoyable of a film. To your point, like, yes, it has to be darker. That's Broadway in general. If you ever split Hamilton into two halves, which will eventually happen, I guarantee it, they're going to make that into a movie. The second half, inevitably, when it comes out a year later, will not be as good as the first, because the first half is just much, much more fun. It's allowed to be lighter. And that's the case here. So I do wish that they had leaned into Glinda a little better on the script in the first hour of this, because it just, the first hour is fucking rough, dude.
Yeah, I think that's all fair feedback. I think at the end of the day, though, again, like, the pacing and the storyline of the musical really lands. And what we tried to add here is the things that create problems a little bit. And because it is still anchored in this, many of the same songs, I still have a great time watching it. And I still think it's very visually stimulating. But I think the last thing that we kind of need to talk about before we wrap is what the core love story is here, at least for me, and in the musical as well, of like what this is titled for is the For Good, right? Is the For Good between Elphaba and Glinda. Mm-hmm. And I will say at the top, I love that the core love story here is about friends. And it's not just that it's two women, it's just two friends who love each other very much and are very different and want similar things, but they want to go about it wildly different ways. And they can still really love each other throughout that. And even though I don't agree personally, I'm not a Glinda, right? Like, I don't agree with the way that she handled it. I would have been an Elphaba. I would have been like, we got to burn this shit to the ground. But I love how much she loves her anyway. You know, that radical acceptance of you are who you are and I am who I am. And they're so different, but they're rooted in this love and respect of each other from these very different parties and the way that they have gotten to this point. And that's the part I love about that song. That's the part I love about this story, is I think at the end of the day, it becomes more about their relationship than Elphaba's happy ending or Glinda's happy ending. It's about their love story as friends.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Just for the record, though, you said you would be more of an Elphaba, but would you do the did we need the skateboarding on the broomstick bit? That was an addition from the musical that I was just like, what, who the fuck is this for? Who needs this?
No, we didn't need that.
I'm gonna grind the broom on the yellow brick road. Yeah, like Tony Hawk's
when you skater. Saw it, did people like react to that in theaters? Because in my theater they did.
What did they do? Clap?
They like were like, ooh, like there were like reactions to her like stunts.
Get the fuck out of here, dude.
I know. I was like, also, and I'm not saying like, whatever, it's fine. It didn't offend me, but I was like, y'all, it's not worth that.
This is such a minor like quibble, because I feel like if you watch Marvel movies, which I do, like the older one, and enjoy them, it's such a minor quibble, but it feels like Elphaba's powers through this are kind of inconsistent, like what she can and can't do. And she's like kicking all these soldiers' asses in the beginning there and skateboarding on her broomstick. And then later she just kind of gets like held down by three of them. And it's like, we're going to kill you now. And it's like, okay. Same with Madame Morrible. Like there's some inconsistencies there. It's such a minor thing, but
I think that's true of the musical as well. I mean, again, if we think about what happens to Fiero and he gets turned into, again, spoilers, we told you, but just Scarecrow, right? And that's in an effort of her to save him, but she doesn't ultimately know what she's doing. And that is so important in the first half of like, she's just doing spells and hoping that they work out.
And she does narrate you through it. She says, I don't know what some of these mean. Like they make it very clear that she's not sure what she's casting.
Totally. But I think the problem is twofold. One, she keeps risking it. And just doing, and then things happen like Tin Man and Scarecrow and all these things. And she just keeps trying. But the other thing that this second half is trying to tell us is that she's matured in her witchcraft and she has learned and she's more, you know, she's more powerful and all these things. But you're right. It's like she has control over certain things and not others that are very impactful at many points in the story.
Can I throw a random theory out to you? You tell me if I'm wrong here. Because we talked about how due to This was what I was going to say before we got into spoilers. They don't want this movie to be about the Wizard of Oz. They don't want it to be about Dorothy, which is why it's a conscious decision to not right. show Dorothy on screen. This is all simultaneously happening, but it's tied to those events, which is why the second like hour and a half of this moves so quickly. And they mm-hmm. gloss over a lot of the negatives of what the Wicked Witch is doing. We kind of cut from, you killed my sister, you stole her shoes, now I'm mad. And then like 2 mm-hmm. minutes later, she's kidnapped Dorothy and them. That's when she gets the letter from Fiero written on the scarecrow cloth. Are we to assume that that's from when the flying monkeys like take his arms and they fling them over there? And they take his legs and they fling them over there. And he like, by the way, I'm Fiero. Give this to fucking help him, please. He's like, cut in half.
Really quick before I lose my arms, let me just write this out.
And she's like, oh shit, I didn't know I turned him into a scarecrow. But he's like a sleeper cell agent, which is kind of cool for Fiero, you know?
I do like that for Fiero in general. I don't love that she doesn't know what she turns him into, and then later she finds out and all is well, you know, ish, kind of. And then they're also supposed to like still be in love, and I'm like, he's a scarecrow now. So
I mean, the first time they had sex was a little different than what I've ever seen, so you know.
Maybe I mean, it's none of my business, right? Two consenting whatevers, have a great time. However, I was like, oh, I have questions.
The tying into that, I wanted to mention just the Tin Man Bach here. I don't know if I was supposed to, but I thought the biggest moment of unintentional comedy in this was when he gets turned into the Tin Man and Elf was doing the spell. Nessa goes outside. She comes out. She's like, I think I fixed him, blah, 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 leaves. And then Nessa's like, darling, darling, where are you? And he fucking like Jack Nicholson in The Shining, the door, like he like kicks through. And I'm like, what the fuck? This is such an overreaction.
It is so funny you say that, because I actually thought the exact same thing when I watched it. I was like, this is very Shining. This is very Jack Nicholson Shining moment. 100%.
It's horrifying. And I'm like, why it's is really he doing intense. This? He still knows how doors work. He didn't. They took he's your real heart mad. Out your brain.
He's real mad.
So I wanted to play this for you, and we can cut this out if it doesn't for some reason play over the mic. I'm going to play it off Instagram because I didn't want to impersonate it. I want to give credit to the original source material. So this is from @antiquatedomens on Instagram. And basically the first thing you guys are going to hear, he's in costume as the Tin Man. And it says the Tin Man in 1939. So Wizard of Oz version of Tin Man. And the second thing you're going to hear is Tin Man in 2025 in this version of it and the difference between the two characters. So I'm going to play this for you guys really quick. I hope it comes through clearly. If not, we can mark it. Here we go.
Okay, I'm ready.
We gotta save Dorothy from the Wicked Witch, and then maybe the wizard will give me a heart.
She turned me into a soulless freak! She gave this lion trauma! Crucify!
So that's @antiquatedomens. Go watch that reel. It is both versions of the titties. Like, oh, I guess we gotta go get the witch so she can give me a hop. Like, it's brilliant.
Oh yeah, that's really different. It also like, you're, to your point though, like putting those right next to each other, you're like, wait, Tin Man and Wizard of Oz like does not know what's going on, not right. really. Yeah. So this is so different. He's so much more ragey.
I mean, at the end of the day, guys, the person who wrote Wizard of Oz is not the same person writing the or who wrote the, no. the novel, obviously. So there's going to be some inconsistencies. Even the Cowardly Lion. I'm like, fuck the Cowardly Lion, narc motherfucker. Like, he's just.
I thought that. I'm glad you said that actually before we wrap, because I think that's so shitty that they're so that the Cowardly Lion is so mad at her. Like, what a fucking reach for that trauma of like, she defended him so he can never defend himself again. Bitch,
she took me out of a cage where I was safe. Ugh.
Gross. Right. No, that was too much. I thought that was too much. I agree. Ugh. Well, here's again my summation here would be, I think that we took a really well-paced, well-structured, really entertaining and beautiful musical and broke it into two films.
Yeah.
And it fundamentally changed the pacing and the storyline a bit in ways that do not quite translate. However, the anchor of the musical numbers and the story that we know, if you do know it from the musical, really help me still really enjoy this. Me personally, I still have a good time watching this. I don't think it's perfect. I don't think we needed two necessarily, or if we did, we could have done a little bit different. But I still enjoy watching this musical because I just love the original so much, and I think it gives a lot of power to this. And I think the way that they add to the production value in the film on the whole is still really cool. Like the sets and the magic and the costumes.
The things that we talked about this during part one was the things you can do with films compared to what you can do on stage. Yeah. It offers up a lot of opportunity, and I do think they take full. The entire No Good Deed sequence is incredible. Of at the castle, and she's walking around. It's almost like the castle itself is kind of suspended, but some of the visuals in that are great.
And I like that they add in like the closet thing in there. It was a little weird. It's not in the musical, but I thought it was rooted in actual emotional progression of the characters. It felt legitimate. And what was funny to me, as I learned later, is like when Cynthia Erivo, Elphaba, pulled her into the closet there to tell her, like, I love you. One, you never hear that in the musical. It's a big departure. And two, she didn't know, Glinda didn't know that was going to happen. So like the trust and the action there is real. It's a real reaction to, you know, Cynthia Erivo's tells her like, it's okay, everything's going to be fine. That's her, like, that's their relationship, I think, coming through on the screen as well, of this real bond that they had. And I actually think that's sweet. I think it's cool how, I mean, there's been much discussion about how close they are and all these things. And I just think it's a really positive reflection of how they've identified with their characters and with each other. And that particular scene, even though it was really different, felt genuine, felt like these characters do really love each other. And at the end of the day, that's a bit what this story is about, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, I didn't know that was added because I've only seen the musical once, so I didn't know that line was added. But I think it works really well, even if you know nothing about sort of the relationship and friendship between the two actresses. the last thing I wanted to finish on, I had a couple notes that didn't really fit anywhere else. One thing I didn't like, and I think, again, this comes back to the musical, We've talked about how we gloss over some of the Wicked Witch's evil deeds for the sake of, you know, keeping this to only being 2 hours long. The whole shoes thing doesn't land for me. Her hating Dorothy and doing all these things just because she has her dead sister who was in a bad relationship with her anyways, shoes. And when she has Dorothy kidnapped and she says, you're going to take those shoes off, I'm going to lock you in the basement. That does not hit for me. It's like, is this really about shoes? And would Dorothy not just give you the shoe? I don't know. I've never read that way to me.
And she doesn't do it. I mean, I think it's another one of those where like we get too much and too little at the same time. Like either commit to that bit and tell me the rest of that scene or don't. You know, it's a little bit too much of a snippet. But I think in the story a little bit, the shoe thing makes sense. Like they're kind of these, like, not just her sister, but it's this familial connection. And that's like her last kind of connection to her family at this point. So even though it feels kind of superficial, I think it is rooted in this is, you know, at this point, kind of an heirloom of my family. It's this one memory and one tangible connection I have to this old life. And while it does go up pretty far, I can understand why she would want them back as much as she does. And yeah, I think that's one that's maybe not handled perfectly here either.
Yeah. I do like the callback.
They're really pretty though. Let's be honest. Like I would also really want them.
I was confused when I was watching this because I was like, wait, why are the shoes? I thought they were ruby red the whole time in Wizard of Oz, but apparently this is a shout out to like before Technicolor. Like they were not known as being ruby red. It was like a big flex by Wizard of Oz.
In Wizard of Oz, they are silver. They made them red for Wizard of Oz in the movie, the original movie.
Okay. So I'm like that tracks because I was like, wait, I thought the whole time. And in this, they go red and then silver and then not. There was one last, speaking of Wizard of Oz, when Elphaba writes our wizard lies and then Morrible changes
Madame Morrible changes it.
The wizard dies or whatever. Wizard must die. I forget what she
wizard
puts up
die.
There.
Wizard must die. Yeah.
What do you think in Wizard of Oz when she wrote surrender Dorothy? What do you think the original message was before Morrible changed? It was like, hey, there's been a big misunderstanding, Dorothy. You're wearing my dead sister's shoes. I'm not all that bad. And
Dorothy, just give me the shoes. Yes. I just want the shoes. Can I... Listen, meet me here at noon with the shoes. That's it.
I feel like Morrible should have just changed it to "You are dead,
you, Dorothy." But like "you," the letter "you," the letter "r," dead.
And then the very last thing I promise that just did not fit anywhere else, but I had to tell this story. So we went and saw this in upstate New York with Janelle's friend Pat and his girlfriend Olivia, and I have to shout them out. Olivia convinced Pat to come see this despite not seeing the first Wicked.
Wow.
So that's clueless. He's never seen, you know, he's never seen the musical. He's never seen the first half of this. So you can imagine what it's like starting from scratch at the beginning of this, and they're trying to kind of catch you up despite it not being a part two. But just
I would never do that, by the way, with somebody. I would be like, I refuse. I'm not going to explain. I do not have the patience to explain this to you.
Well, to that point, after the movie, we debriefed in the lobby, as we do, us movie lovers. And he's the funniest takeaway was that when Elphaba goes down into the basement and finds all the caged animals, she sees the goat there. And she says, like, "Dr. Dillamond?" and walks up to the goat and goes, "Can you speak?" And he goes, "Eh." And everyone's like, all of us that have seen the first half are like, "Oh no, he's been," to him, he's like, "What the fuck is wrong? It's a goat. He's doing what goats do. Like, why is this goat? Where did he get his doctorate?"
He's so, like, "Yeah, he's good."
I just had to tell that story of like how lost you might be if you don't bother seeing the first half. But shout out to Pat.
Especially all the like animal, any of that. Yeah. You're like, I don't understand. That's how animals work. Yeah, I mean, the caging part.
What's wrong with
the
situation?
Bad,
but... why is the wizard so bad? Like,
yeah. Oh, that's amazing. I love that. Yeah. A credit also to your group to be like, yeah, we're going to take a person and then explain everything to them after. Absolutely not. I would not. Okay. Well, with all of that in mind, one last nugget I will give you guys. We are definitely criticizing the way it translates to film and the breakout into two pieces. But I would still say, one, I still have a good time with musicals in general, but I also love the OG musical. So I still had a good time. This also is still fucking making money. As of last check, we are at $150 million from a budget perspective. And it's $415 million and climbing in terms of what it has made. And it's still in theaters right now. So you can go see it right now if you want. So I don't think we've seen the end of this.
Yeah, y'all really better get ready for fucking Wicked for Even Gooder, part three.
Wicked-a. Well, so shit here, got gonna... real.
Yes, she did. I'm gonna challenge you here. I'm gonna have you give your rating first, but here's how I'm gonna play.
God
this.
Damn it! I don't.
I want
I do not
you to give
to that.
To what? But it ties into exactly what you just said. I want you to give your rating for this film for good, but then just give me a rating of front to back, Wicked, both parts as one cohesive unit. Like, what would you rate that?
Oh, that's fun. Okay, fair. I didn't rate this because y'all know I gut checked these on the fly. Because why not? I talking it through actually helped me a little bit because even though, again, I didn't take notes in real time, I walked out of there going, that was a good time. That's that was what I left the theater with. But I do see a little bit more some of the flaws, I would say. So I think I would probably give this like a 7 out of 10.
Okay.
I think the anchor songs and story are still there, still really strong. Visually, it's really good. The effects are really cool. There are like a handful of cheesy things again that I'm like, didn't work for me, or it was a pacing problem. But I still love the overall story. I think the overall of the two, I'd go a little higher. I'd probably go like an 8 out of 10 altogether. Again, my favorite, I think I said this in the first half as well. I don't love the add-in songs. I don't think that's because they're bad songs, right? I think that's because I'm a purist of the musical and I love the original musical songs and I don't necessarily need or want more. I am more like you could fill more story or whatever. So I didn't love the add-in songs I remember from the first half as well. So I think like an 8-ish. I still love this story. I think it's such a unique take all the way back to the novel of like, how do we tell this story from a different lens? And I always like just deeply respect that. And I think the production value, again, is really cool, really well done. And I think the performances are really solid. And I like the overall message here of that, that friendship that kind of carries us through this whole story. So yeah, probably like 8 out of 10 for both. What do you think?
I think I'm almost exactly aligned with you This is definitely the weaker of the two. It's through no fault of the movie itself, because it's based on the musical. You can't change too much. But we've talked through the missteps, the things I don't like. I do still feel as though Michelle Yeoh is a bit of a miscast. I feel like if you're going to embrace the Glinda of the story and try to pad the movie a little bit, they could have done it a little better. They also could have accelerated the first hour and decelerated the last hour. Like, you could get creative with how you pace this a bit better to work alongside mm-hmm. Wizard of Oz, just to make it feel less like herky jerky in the last hour. It just felt like every 10 minutes there was a massive character shift of now I'm evil. No, now I'm good. No, now we're enemies. Now we're friends. It's very sudden. So I think with that, I would give this one like a 6.5. I don't think it's very much worth seeing, but I did mm-hmm. not love the experience this go round. But same as you overall, if I were to push them back to back and watch them the way they were intended, then I'd probably go 8. I still think it's really worth watching, but I think the strength is in the first half of seeing these characters built up. And then you get the happy coincidence of this is how it ties into that thing you liked from, you know, 70 years ago. That I think is what works about it. So I would go with a solid 8 in that case, but the second half is a little rougher.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I don't think we've ever aligned so well on a thing.
Well, we've never done a double ranking. I don't think like a double rating.
I don't think so. Look at you breaking new ground. I like it. Okay. Well, all that to say, guys, like, I still think it's worth, it's definitely an in theater experience, in my opinion. Sure. I think you should still go see it in theaters. Yeah. So while it's out, like, we would absolutely say go see it for mm-hmm. sure. So, well, thanks for joining us on Wicked Part 2 for good, or as we would like to call it, Shit Gets Real. I still think that's the contender, right? We didn't have a better one.
I think that was the top.
I think that's the best one. Yeah, I think that's the best one. All right. This was super fun for me. All these musicals are fun for me, but come back next week for Cabaret, which is classic. Oh, that's right. I mean, I keep being surprised by that, but like, you haven't seen a lot of these. I don't know why I'm surprised.
I think aside from the one we're doing at the end of this month, I haven't seen 4 of the 5 films we're doing this month. So
yeah. Oh, so fun. Cabaret is a classic. If you haven't seen it, I recommend watching it before we cover it. But In the meantime,
follow us on our socials. We drink and we watch things, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. You can get the video there. You can also get video on Spotify, and you can always email us. We drink and we watch things pod@gmail.com. We got Fan Jan coming up in about 4 weeks, so we'll probably be running some polls to vote on our Instagram. So make sure you vote there to see which movies you want us to do in January. But yeah, give us a like, follow, subscribe, comment, whatever floats your boat.
All the things, whatever your vibe is. However, I will say your rec so far for Fan Jan,
Mackenzie's not a loving big fan.
It's not my favorite thing. I would like better recs. Okay, just putting that in now. Anyways, all right. For now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.